Representative Simonson moves the minutes of March 4th. Any additions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing or seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Simonson. Okay, now I will move House File 446 to be moved to Public Safety. Chair Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This bill adds a new 446 adds a new subdivision to existing child support law to provide direction to the court on how to award the child income tax dependency exemption. The court's always had this ability to award these, but there's been no previous direction in how the law on how to award them or on how the award of the exemption interacts with the federal code on deductions. So this provides clarification on how the award in a child support or custody case interact with what is required by the IRS and how it interacts with the new tax credits through the Affordable Care Act. It does not change the existing child support provisions, which allows the court to deviate on a child support calculation based on the award of the dependency exemption. And it's going to go to public. And that's it, Mr. Chair. The fiscal note came back with a zero cost. I don't think it. I can answer any questions that the committee might have.
Okay, before we go to questions from members, what we'll do is, does the department, is anyone here from the department, do they have any comments on House File 446? And I see you have a witness.
She's here to answer questions if needed.
As a resource? Yes. Okay, why don't you join Chair Mahoney there? I will go to member questions now. Questions for members? Okay, seeing none, do you want to wrap it up there, Chair Mahoney?
It's a good bill. Vote for it.
Fine piece of legislation. Okay, so the motion, I'll renew my motion that House File 446 be referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Chair Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Item next, either House File 407 or House File 290. Are either of the authors here? For those? Okay, then we're going to go to Representative Swazinski moves House File 441, and the motion will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for House File 441? Anyone with concerns? The department? Do we have the department here today? Oh, man. Today's the day to get bills through. Right to the floor. We're going. No. Okay, so Representative Swazinski moves House File 441. Representative, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the Tax Committee. Just want to run this bill. This House File 441 is a pretty straightforward bill that takes the taxes above and beyond the 6.5%, the 9.2% sales tax that's on rented vehicles or short-term lease vehicles, and simply takes those funds that are currently being deposited into the general fund and puts them straight into the Quarters of Commerce program. I think we're all familiar with what the Quarters of Commerce program does. It does projects throughout the state to help aid the economic vitality of our transportation system in terms of business and commuters and getting our goods to market. And I'd certainly appreciate the committee's support on its possible inclusion onto the tax omnibus bill.
Okay, Representative, the gentleman from Lyon, I believe you would like to move the... is this your amendment? It's the H-0441-A-2?
Yes, I believe it's a technical amendment. Let me grab it out of my pack.
Well, we generally want to get it in the shape that you would like.
Having that
Chair Carlson.
Form that I showed you that I'm being distributed. I put my name on your copy, but my name isn't on the others, and just so committee members.
Thank you.
Know
so committee members know the document that's being passed out now is the Carlson document. We have a signed copy at the chair's table here. So that is from Chair Carlson. Representative Wozinski.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, this amendment was brought with the fiscal staff, just trying to clarify the language to do what we wanted to do. So.
Okay, so Representative Wozinski moves H.O. 441A2. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye. Or excuse me, Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, not on the amendment.
Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails to the bill as amended. Chair Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, where is this going? I don't think transportation has seen this.
Representative Wozinski?
Mr. Chair, yes. Representative Earhart, that bill was before the committee last week, I believe, with you there.
Chair Earhart?
I was just curious about that. We are, and I don't know if maybe I wasn't there the day they did this. I was probably doing something important. Oh, well, come on.
That was good.
I was just wondering if we're kind of earmarking something here and we shouldn't really be doing this. Because I don't think the... we're actually spending money for a specific purpose, and we don't usually do that. So if there's anybody around that remembers how we get into vicious fights over pots of money going for this highway or that highway or this bridge or that highway, why you wouldn't do this. In effect, I don't know as the amendment actually does it. Does it? It just says to you're earmarking it by bill, but the amendment just says in the trunk highway fund. And you're trying to say that this money is going into the trunk highway fund specifically for the quarters of commerce. And I don't think that that's kosher. Or even right.
Mr. Michael, could you kind of, as amended, what are we doing here?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, essentially what the amendment does is to clarify the fund in the state treasury that the Corridor of Commerce program is in, which is it's in the trunk highway fund, and so it simply adds the reference to make it clear that that's where the money is going to be deposited.
Chair Earhart? Chair Knobloch?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I certainly know that in the past we haven't had a tradition of earmarking normally for specific projects, but I think this is a little bit different than that. We're simply saying this money would go towards the Corridors of Commerce program, and we've appropriated lots of other money to the Corridors of Commerce program over the years, so I guess I'm not sure that I consider this earmarking in the same way that I think you're concerned about, Chair Earhart.
Thank you. Chair Anderson.
Mr. Chair, if Mr. Michael maybe can clarify, in the original language, though, it specifically says corridors of commerce, but in the amended languages, it says for expenditures related. Are there other things within the Trunk Highway Fund then that this money could be used for?
Mr. Michael. Or Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, this was the language that was actually proposed or discussed with our transportation analysts, and we think it does limit it just to the corridors of commerce.
Okay. And Mr. Chair to Representative Wozinski, of the $331 million that has been allocated to the corridors of commerce already, what have those projects been? Do you have a list?
One from Lyon.
Yeah, I've got a partial list. You can go just to the Department of Transportation's website. They have a full list of what has been funded in the past. There was an original $300 million of potential bonded projects, and then last year they did about $31 million into that program. Those projects, I believe, off the top of my head, approximately $6 million of that 31 was for Greater Minnesota projects, and then the rest of it was, I think, throughout the state. So Highway 69, Highway 14, across the state, and that can be dollars both for actual projects, but then also the planning phase of those projects as well.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for members? Chair Carlson?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, this might be the time for me to chime in. I did pass out some information if in the distribution Hennepin and Ramsey were included, but I do want to give a little backdrop. Some of you may remember last spring we had the supplemental appropriations bill, and there, quite frankly, was a huge windfall as a result of the tax on motor vehicles, and all that money was basically earmarked for 1 year at that point in time to go to Greater Minnesota. And I worked with legislators from Greater Minnesota at the time, as well as the collar counties, those outside of Hennepin and Ramsey, on a redistribution last year that provided equity by making sure that we had a win-win. We worked with MDOT to put more money into the corridors of commerce and then moved the sales tax on rental vehicles into the collar counties. And so it ended up being a wash. And the Greater Minnesota reps that I was working with on the Transportation Committee in particular were quite pleased that they were getting money for the corridors of commerce, and it was an equal amount. And then that put that windfall, if you will, which was much greater than anybody had expected when I say windfall, into the outline counties that are on the list. I don't know why historically, maybe somebody on this committee or in the audience that knows how that original distribution came about in the metro area where Hennepin and Ramsey were excluded. But I'm here today would argue that we need to bring about more equity with that distribution to include Hennepin and Ramsey. Now, I did have a handout that we could have put out there that would have shown if we recognized Hennepin and Ramsey at 100% of their population.
Chair Carlson, excuse me, are you talking about House File 441 or?
Well, the distribution, they both distribute the funds. So that's why I was asking you if this would be timely to bring that up or not.
Well, you certainly can, but I think it's more into 710 if we get.
If you want me to wait until 710, but being that both bills deal with the distribution, that's why I was talking.
And they
about
do,
it.
And yeah. They do.
That's why I'll leave it to you then, Mr. Chairman, where the best point to have that discussion. That's why I said it would be a good time.
If it's okay with you, when we go to House File 710, after the presentation, it'll be the first question.
Okay. And I'll try not to repeat too many of my comments.
Oh, no, that's fine. Yeah. That's fine.
Okay, I'll wait.
We've got two bills that have some similar things, so if that's okay with you.
No, that's fine.
Okay. Questions for the gentleman from Lyon? Okay, with that... the gentleman from Lyon renews his motion that House File 441 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. On affairs, oh no, we're not. We don't vote on that. Sorry. So we did it. You're good.
Thank you.
Good to go. Okay, so that's where we're at there. And then I'm going to go with House File 290. And I think the bulk of the time, members, there's going to be a lot of discussion on 710, and we will start out with Chair Carlson when we get back to that. So it would be my intention to go 290, 407, and then spend the balance of the time on 710. Okay, welcome, committee. I will move House File 290. Do you have any amendments, Representative?
No, I do not, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Keel, why don't you tell us what your bill does?
Well, you know, in conversation of trying to figure out how to encourage people to plan for their senior years and or maybe even some health events, we talk about how do we encourage people to plan for health care in long term. And this was just an idea, a suggestion that maybe people that are, you think about when you're raising your children, you get to your later 40s, early 50s, and think, maybe this would be a good time to invest in long-term care. And so the idea behind this was maybe you can't finance the whole thing, but could use some of your retirement before you turn 59 and a half to help supplement that type of insurance. And so, like I want to make sure you understand, this is a tool in the toolbox. This isn't for everyone, nor is it possible for everyone, but also is an opportunity to help families plan for future needs and maybe invest in long-term care. And so it's I hesitate to say it's a simple bill, but it's really intended to just be a tool that people can use. And I don't know, Mr. Chair, if Mr. Michael would like to explain a little bit more about the detail of this.
Okay, yeah, and I think we will do that. Thank you, Representative. But I've got a couple questions for Mr. Michael. This is drafted on 1.12. We're talking 72 T's. Should we also, should we also be talking 72 Q's?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think so, because this is intended to get at the additional tax that applies to early withdrawal from retirement plans, and that is imposed by 72T, as I recall the code.
But, Mr. Michael, if you have a 72Q, you could have an older contract that has a tremendous amount of gain where they would be in the same situation on the gain, not the basis.
Mr. Chair, this bill is intended to address the 10% additional tax, not the regular tax that's imposed. I think the provision under 72Q is, as you indicate, the regular tax. There's not, I don't believe that applies to early withdrawals, but if you want to expand this to other, you certainly could expand this to apply to other additional taxes.
Mr. Murray, let's talk about that later, because I think that the 72Q would treat the gain in the same way that does on a qualified plan under 72T, I think. We'll talk about that. Okay, this is a very intriguing bill. This is a page turner for me. One page turner. So basically, members, what we're looking at here is there's various forms of long-term care. So you have a long-term care policy, formerly known as like a nursing home policy, but it's really long-term care. And so we're not talking about that, because the 59.5 rule doesn't apply to that. Long-term care put on a life insurance policy, we're not talking about that, because that comes through without the 59.5 rule as basically an accelerated death benefit. The 72, this would be like an IRA, a SEP, a simple 401k. Mr. Michael, 401k, but that some of those, depending on the plan document, could be like 55.
Mr. Chair, I believe that this is IRA, so that's a separate, just like you're indicating with the variable annuities, that this would be a, we could expand this to include all of those other types of plans, but the way it's been drafted is for the IRAs and the stuff where they've been rolled over to IRAs. So
a traditional, a simple, and a SEP. How about a Roth that they haven't held in 5 years? That'd be 72T?
Mr. Chair, I don't remember whether there is a 10% tax on that or not, or whether that would, I mean, I would have to go back and look and come up with a list of the plans that would be affected, that would not be covered by this.
So 72T should be traditional simple SEP.
Right.
Okay, so with that, basically what you're looking at is if somebody has an IRA and they're 49 and they have a tragic accident and end up in a nursing home, they could pull out of their IRA and they'd get a credit for the 10% IRS penalty.
Correct.
Okay. Okay, Mr. Michael, do you want to kind of just give a brief synopsis of the bill here, if you would, please?
Mr. Chairman, what this bill does is to provide a refundable tax credit for the additional tax that applies when somebody takes a withdrawal from an IRA or other one of those qualifying plans before they've reached the age of 59 and a half, and so therefore the federal law imposes a 10% additional tax that people frequently call a penalty on those withdrawals, in addition to having that distribution included in your ordinary income. And this, so this refundable credit would apply if the individual uses the distribution for qualified long-term care expenses. And that could either be paying for direct care or it could be buying long-term care insurance. Under federal law, that additional tax does not apply if you use it to pay for medical expenses for the taxpayer, spouse, or dependent. So, and if those expenses would qualify for the itemized deduction, so if they exceed that 10% threshold for non-elderly or 7.5% threshold for the for elderly. And essentially that's what it does, is it essentially says the state, through this credit, will pay that additional tax rather than the federal government, which sort of makes it easier for people to use these monies to pay for long-term care. It doesn't say who the long-term care has to be paid for, so it could be used for the, you know, for the taxpayer, the spouse, or a tax dependent like a child who's got special needs or something like that, but it also could be used for someone who's not a tax dependent, like a parent of the taxpayer or something like that.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. Under 72T, though, if you set it up over 5 years, let's say you're 55 and you go 55 to 60, there wouldn't be a penalty imposed anyways because of 72T.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. There are various ways that you can avoid this additional tax. In that case, this bill would not come into effect, and what you're referring to is that rule that allows if you take substantially equal payments over a minimum of 5 years, then the additional 10% tax does not apply.
Thank you, Mr. Michaels. What this bill does basically encourages buying a long-term care policy, which would hopefully relieve the state of some costs, because instead of spending down and going on the state coffers, you would use your long-term care policy to provide it. Chair Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this really isn't a question for Representative Keel, but Mr. Chair, just listening to you and your expertise in this area, my guess is you're going to get awfully interested in this legislation before we adjourn. And, you know, just thinking about it, I mean, Representative Keel may not know, and others may not know, we have a tax credit for people to buy long-term care insurance in this state right now, and it's an utter and abject failure, in my opinion. So this would be another one. So, you know, Mr. Chair, I would
Let's
hope...
Let's give peace a chance.
Yeah, I would, you know, I tried to repeal it.
I know.
But, you know, I didn't succeed on that. But, I mean, you know, so we do have this long-term credit right now. I mean, Minnesotans, if you go buy a long-term health care policy, you can get an income tax credit right now. I think it costs us, I don't know, Ms. Manzi or someone could tell us, $9 or $10 million a year, and it doesn't work. It's not making anybody buy long-term health care, really. I mean, it's been pretty much demonstrated that it's not really doing what it was designed to do. You know, maybe, Mr. Chair, you would consider, if you get into this, looking at that one, too, in concert, and how that would work if that money should instead be moved to do something like this. I don't know if I have an opinion on this one, but just saying that, or maybe you could come up with a, you know, something like this and the current credit and abolish both and come up with something that would actually work. I mean, because what we're doing is we make all taxpayers pay higher taxes so that some get a tax credit to purchase their long-term health care insurance, and that would be a great objective if people actually did it, because as you said, Mr. Chair, then that lowers the cost for all Minnesotans because people buy a policy instead of going sort of on the public system. But it really hasn't worked out that way. So I just, Mr. Chair, I hope you'll look at that in collectively with the credit. I think this, the way I'm understanding this, is this, you could use it at a younger, you know, it would appeal to you at a younger age, but that also applies for the current long-term credit now. And I don't know if Ms. Manzi could tell us. I think you get like $100 a year or something if you buy your long-term care credit. And I think even when states have them for a much higher amount, they still don't work. So I don't know if you want to get into that.
Yeah, no, I do, Ms. Manzi, to that point. So what are we spending on the current program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lencheski, the current long-term care credit is around $8 to $9 million per year, and Ms. Templin may have more precise figures, but that's you were correct when you said it was about $9 to $10 million. I think maybe it's a little less than that, but that's certainly the neighborhood of the cost. The credit equals 25% of premiums paid up to a maximum credit of $100. If the taxpaying unit is a married couple filing jointly and each spouse has a policy, then they each may claim the credit. So a married couple could get a credit of up to $200.
Carolyn Chesky. No, thank you. And you bring up a very important point, because it probably hasn't quite worked the way. In fact, we have another bill, O'Driscoll. We're going to be looking at that issue, too. And maybe I think your idea is really good to be able to merge things. Now, I know it's a revenue note. It's kind of hard to score. There, we don't have any numbers for revenue note, but throughout the process, you know, especially if you can get people. Now, you'd have to buy a qualified long-term care. Now, members, what that means is if you have a qualified plan that will pay out $300,000 and you've gone through the $300,000, your new spend down instead of $3,000 is $300,000. So that's very advantageous in estate planning to do this. But I agree with Carolyn Chesky. We need to put something together that works, because this is going to become a bigger issue as we go down the road here, because I'm not getting any younger. It's kind of the way it is. Chair Knobloch.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think you maybe just made my point earlier that I understand this bill. It sounds like what it really is that if medical expenses and disability expenses are something for which you can already withdraw money out of your IRA without a penalty, this bill effectively says that you can have your penalty forgiven if you buy long-term care insurance with the money you take out. And I think that's what you were saying, Chair Davids, and I guess is that Representative Keel, the practical effect of this bill?
That's correct.
Okay.
Okay, and, now just a second. It says, Chair Knobloch, it says qualified long-term care expenses. Now, where did I just say?
Mr. Chair, but if I'm looking at the revenue note underneath current law, the third sentence says the additional 10% tax does not apply to withdrawals due to total and permanent and disability for medical expenses or other reasons. So I'm gathering that if you took money out of your IRA because you had to go into a nursing home because you had a bad accident or something, that then you wouldn't pay the 10% penalty anyway.
I understand that way, Chair. Now, to Mr. Michael, okay, so you have the bad accident, you're 49 years old, you go in the nursing home, you take out of your IRA. Currently, you could use money penalty-free from the IRS 59.5 rule if you took it out for medical services. And so all this bill is doing is saying that if you have qualified long-term care costs or to buy a long-term care insurance contract, okay, so you take the money out, you still have a taxable event.
Mr. Chair, I think two things. Correct. This, you take the money out, it's going to be included in your income and subject to the regular income tax rate. So you will end up paying tax on this. What this credit avoids is the additional 10% tax, or what people call the penalty. And as has been pointed out and is in the revenue estimate, under current law, if amounts that qualify for the itemized deduction already can be taken out without regard to the 10% additional tax/penalty. That is limited to the amount that's over your AGI threshold, though. So, and that's 10% for somebody who's not over 65. So, this would cover two situations. So, when you're paying for those medical costs, to the extent these long-term care things count as medical expenses, and most or many of them would, including the insurance, that's already free of the penalty, but the amount under the AGI threshold would be subject to the penalty. And secondly, there may be some, I mean, what long-term care is about is helping, in part, is helping people who are incapable of doing some of these, what are called, major life activities, you know, like bathing and brushing your teeth and getting in and out of chairs and that sort of thing. that's not medical care, but that would, you know, would be covered by this sort of thing too. So that's the two categories, amounts up to the threshold, and then these things that don't qualify as medical expenses but are long-term care expenses.
Thank you, Michael. Chair Knobloch?
No further questions.
Chair Torkelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Lincheski brought up the current program that's costing us somewhere around $9 to $10 million. Of that cost, how much of that is that all the $100 credit, or is there other costs involved in that program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, that's the income tax revenue that's foregone because of the $100 credit. That's all it is. There's nothing else.
Chair Torkelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So according to my math, there's about 90,000 people taking part. Is it 9,000? I should never do math in public, Mr. Chair.
Just a moment.
It's a dangerous thing to do.
Ms. Manzi, can you do the math?
No, I have the short subject. It's here. No, it's in here. Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, in tax year 12, there were 62,128 Minnesota returns that claimed the credit. Some of them were returns filed by married couples who each had policies, and that's why the count is less than the 90,000 you arrived at. And the amount of the credit in tax year 2012 was $8.66 million.
Chair Torkelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there's 90,000 or so people out there that have a policy and are potentially not going to be a burden on the state if they go into nursing home care. So if the program is really working and we had 500,000 people on it, it would be much more expensive. Is that not correct?
Ms. Manson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, if there were 500,000 people claiming this credit who all had tax liability of at least $100 to, you know, have the credit offset, then yes, it would be much more expensive.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the expense is on our current tax system, but hopefully that expense then is made up for by lower costs on the other side. One more question, Mr. Chair.
Chair Torkelson.
What is the likelihood of a taxpayer going into the nursing home? Do we have that number?
I believe it's 7 chances out of 10. Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I don't know that number. That sort of points to one of the issues with the credit being effective or not being effective. There are a number of factors involved. One factor, which is the case with most tax incentives, is that some people would have engaged in the desired behavior absent the tax benefit. So it's only really the people on the margin that the state is benefiting from, and the other people are getting what an economist would call a windfall. Another factor is that there are people who purchase long-term care insurance policies who never end up using them. So the credit paid for to those individuals during the time they're paying their premiums is something that doesn't get recovered because they never go into a nursing home and would not have gotten state assistance for that. And there are some other factors. Mr. Michael has done more reading on this than I have, and we could go into it in more detail if you'd like.
It's pretty exciting stuff.
This is very exciting, Mr. Chair.
Chair Torkelson?
I have goosebumps.
Yeah.
I'll quit with that, Mr. Chair. I don't want to take any more valuable committee time.
Well, that's fine. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do know that when we head toward our 80s, it's closer to 1 in 3, possibly. But nursing home stays, remember, are only the average is only about 30 days of stays. And what is happening to our nursing homes are, I've seen this in my district, they're also becoming a rehab place for people that are much younger, that take that time to maybe get that knee working so that they're able to go home. Those are some of the other things. It depends. A lot of this is variables, and you all know this. It depends on what kind of insurance policy you purchase. A long-term care could also provide you with a nursing service in your home, or a combination of things you would need. So long-term care's got a lot of different variables. depending on the policy you purchase. That's the one key thing, depending on how you purchase it, what your expectations are. And quite often, you have to be in some kind of care for probably 2 to 3 months before your long-term care kicks in. And that also depends on what you choose, how you set up the policy. And many of you probably already are aware of that. But
And also, we don't want to get confused going into a nursing home or a nursing home policy with a long-term care policy, because long-term care includes much more than nursing home. It's in-home daycare, it's adult daycare, it's hospice, it's a whole bunch of different things. So the gentleman from Lyon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question obviously is maybe a little more healthcare related, but just from a tax credit standpoint, we talked about the 60-year, along Representative Torkelson's line of questioning, about family members. So as legislators, we can potentially buy long-term care insurance for our close relatives. Does this tax credit, I mean, as someone that would be buying it on behalf of someone else, it does not. It's only strictly, so I couldn't take out of my potential 401k to purchase on behalf of someone else. It has to be the individual themselves that could receive that tax credit.
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Swedzinski, it's sort of two different things. Under the tax credit that's in current law, the policy would have to be for the taxpayer or the spouse. Now, in that situation, if you wanted to help your children buy a policy, you could certainly give them the money for the policy, and they could buy the policy, and then they could claim the tax credit. What's in the bill, the tax credit proposed in the bill would offset the additional tax on early withdrawals from one of those retirement plans to the extent they were used for anybody's long-term care expenses. So what's under the bill, that tax credit would apply if you were making an early withdrawal from your plan to help pay for the long-term care expenses of your parent or your child or someone else.
Oh, cool. Gentleman from Lyon. Yep. The Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, I mean, it's just a small adjustment, I think, that if it's the penalty. But I don't have any problem with doing it for people who end up in an accident, as you say, or an MS diagnosis or something that strikes early. The chances, perhaps, of having a longer-term retirement may have been shortened by that experience and may have some immediate needs to deal with. I do have some concerns about whether or not we should be incenting people to pull out of retirement savings to buy long-term care insurance. Because the research is pretty clear that the boomers, most of them, not all, but the boomers are not really good at saving for the costs of their retirement years. And there's more and more evidence that they're not going to be able to afford their heating bills and their property tax bills, let alone, and so there's been some pretty good studies done nationally, although the data is not as great as you'd like, but showing that disproportionately, a lot of people discontinue these policies just about the time they get to getting closer to need it. They might pay on these policies through their 50s and their 60s, and then, you know, the savings are gone, and they still got to pay that heat bill and the property tax bill or whatever, and they start, so they discontinue their long-term care insurance premium payments just as they're getting closer to the ages where they might actually need it. And so they've put in all this money into premiums during, you know, maybe their 50s and their 60s, and then when they're getting into their 70s and approaching their 80s, they discontinue it in order just to meet their basic costs of living. And so we just don't yet have a good system for helping people figure out how to save for their retirement so they can, throughout their vital years, you know, meet their basic needs of living. And incenting someone to take away from that retirement savings, I think, is not the right approach for the majority of Minnesotans. It would be a nice, you know, tax relief game for some people who have means, but I think for the majority, the evidence is not clear that long-term care insurance policies are being sold to people who can sustain them throughout their retirement years.
And thank you, Mr. Loeffler. And in the case where someone has, they've got to choose between long-term care and heating or food, they're probably in a situation where if they need the care, they'd be pretty close to a spend-down number where they'd be there. Now, and the other thing to maybe prevent some of that is as a licensed agent in the state of Minnesota, you have to do the suitability reviews and make sure it's a suitable sale, and there are asset tests to do that. So hopefully we're not, you know, not everybody, you know, can afford to buy one. Mm-hmm. And a very good point. And the point is you have to have an IRA in the first place to do it. So that excludes a lot of people. But your points are very well taken. Okay, with that, Chair Anderson. Anybody wish to testify on behalf of the bill or with concerns thereof? Anyone from the department? Man, today's the day to get stuff through. Okay, so with that, Representative Keel, I will move House File 290 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much, and very exciting discussion. Okay, item next. More excitement. House File 407, Representative O'Driscoll. Thank you, Representative Keel.
Thank you.
I will move House File 407, and again, the motion will be to lay over for possible inclusion. Now, on 407, as we do on other bills, is there anyone here to testify on behalf of House File 407 with concerns? The department. Do you want to testify on 407? Okay. Representative O'Driscoll, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I appreciate the trailer on the previous movie to set this one up. We had quite a bit of debate that I think applies to this particular bill as well. It's a pretty straightforward piece of legislation, and again, in the previous discussion that the committee was having, what it does is it moves the individual credit for a qualified purchase on a long-term long-term care policy here in the state of Minnesota from $100 annually to $200 annually, and it moves it from a married couple total credit from $200 annually to $400, and it allows for a doubling of the amount of qualified premium from 25% annually up to that $100-$200 to the $200-$400 at 50%. Mr. Chair, again, we were having some debate and discussion. Perhaps others want to share some thoughts on this, or we've already kind of had that discussion, so I'll turn it back to you.
Well, thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. I think Chair Lencheski brought up some very good points on the current plan. This is basically changing the current plan, putting it on a bit of steroids here, which, you know, I guess I take the attitude that anybody we can get a long-term care policy on that's a suitable sale for should do it, because it does a lot of good things for them in their estate plan and so forth. So I don't know. I don't know how much of the previous discussion you heard. If we need to sit down with Representative Keel and you and Chair Lencheski or whoever is interested in this to maybe put a hybrid together, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but I see what you're trying. Any questions from members on this, Chair Lencheski?
Mr. Chair, I would just simply add, and I apologize, Representative, I didn't know you were in the room and carrying this bill after I was kind of going off on what I thought of the long-term credit, so sorry about that.
I still love you, though, Representative Lencheski.
So sorry about that, and, you know, so I think I understand, you know, what you're trying to do is, you know, have an even better, bigger tax benefit so more people will use it, and that makes sense. I think if you were going to do this, Mr. Chair, I would simply ask that you try to get some empirical research to show that going from 100 to 200 or 1,000 or 2,000 would work, and that's my concern. It's not the good intent of these. You know, I would just, you know, I've always thought that the better use of this money is to give it to the HHS chair, because what you could do with $20 million a year, or in this case more, the HHS chair could lower the cost of long-term health care. And so, you know, it's kind of the select few who figure out how to do this. And I know when my parents purchased long-term health care, they brought their five children into a room and said, instead of leaving you any, you know, money, we're going to buy long-term health care. You know, ha, ha, ha. I mean, that was a joke, but that it's expensive. And it's a very big expense. And for people who do it, they're really a huge, they're helping all of us in the state. Because they're lowering health care costs, and the children of the people who make those decisions to forego other choices and vacations, et cetera, because they're going to pay that premium, they're doing their families a big favor. But it's very expensive, and I guess it's hard for me to imagine how $100 a year or $200 a year is going to dent the cost of that of a decent long-term health care package. So, you know, I just want to apologize to you because my issues with long-term health care credit have been something I felt for a long time just because I don't think they work. So.
Well, and Chairman Chess, you've been very consistent on it. I mean, so. Are we finished? Chair Lincheski.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Chair Anderson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to piggyback a little bit off of what Representative Torkelson referred to, though, earlier. We're looking at 65,000 people that took advantage of getting their long-term care insurance. Do you have any data on how much that has saved the state because they are taking care of their care and we're not having to carry that burden? If you can help me out on that.
Senator O'Driscoll.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, that is a very good question, and it's only speculation, but if you run some kind of quick math on this, if long-term care facility charges $60,000 a year for an individual's care, and that individual had purchased long-term care coverage with the minimum policy requirements of a two-year or a $100,000, $200,000 indemnity on it, and we gave a $100 tax credit over a 30-year period of time, it's $30,000. We've doubled our savings on that for 1 year. And again, does everybody who buys know? Do we know who know? It's an insurance situation, and that's why there's actuaries, and that's why there's premiums, and that's why people pay different rates at different health classifications and all the things that we've been through with health care. So does it help? Yeah. Does it solve our problem? No. Does it bend the curve? I do believe it does.
And Chair Anderson.
Well, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative O'Driscoll. Maybe we need to do a better job too, as a state, as promoting this as a better option for for citizens to do, because it helps them out too. Mm-hmm. You know, quite honestly, I don't know what we do as a state to promote something like this, but something to think about.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll.
I would defer to you for this next question because you were actively working in the industry. My assumption is that we have several hundred thousand policies that have been issued, and if we have 62,000 people who are taking advantage of it, we already have people who aren't taking advantage of the tax credit. We do need to reach those people. I have been criticized, quite frankly, for not having this be larger coming in, but I also want to make sure that we're thinking about and having the conversation and doing the right thing. Everybody in this room, everybody in this committee, everybody in this legislature knows that these aren't the end of our problems with dealing with these kinds of things. We're only at the infancy or the beginning part of this, and we need to do something on it. And so this is my offer to try to help move us in that direction.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. When we say 62,000, correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Mansbury, I think that 62,000 returns were more like about 90,000 actual people.
Mr. Chair, yes, that would be correct.
Okay. And I agree with Chair Lincheski here in that I think we do need to get some data, and I'll work with you on this to get some data as to, and we can figure that out because we can see what the claims paid were versus how many policies got the credit, and so we can just do the math there. But now, Ms. Manzi, on House File 407, does it have to be a qualified plan you buy, or could it be a non-qualified plan also?
Mr. Chair, the bill does not change the type of plan that qualifies for the credit. It just changes the amount of the credit. The policy, to qualify for the credit, the policy has to qualify for the federal itemized deduction for medical expenses, and it has to have a lifetime long-term care benefit limit of $100,000 or more.
That could be non-qualified.
And I think that the person has to be offered the inflation protection, but there was a change to the credit when it was first enacted. Inflation protection was required, and that was changed several years into the credit's existence.
So that's not required now.
I believe that's correct, but it has to be offered to the person. Yep.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, there should have been, and my apologies, you've seen House Research refer to the beige page that they're flipping back and forth. That is actually House Research that they put together that was made available on a November 2014 document, and I did intend to have that forwarded to the committee that kind of outlined some of the things that we were speaking about. And if we didn't get that, my apologies, you can receive that piece from House Research. and they do have it, and it's a very, very intriguing piece of information. When you go through it, it talks about who's qualified, what's qualified, and some of those kinds of things. And the only things, again, that have changed would be the dollar amounts that are being proposed, and this, all other things would stay static as far as qualifications. So, Mr. Chair, thank you for your time.
Okay, we have a few questions.
Oh, all right.
Here, the gentleman from Lyon. Okay, Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, I mean, there's discussion about, you know, in this whole area should, I mean, it's, we're kind of at an inflection point here in this discussion. Should the responsibility of this type of care and the incentives that go with it be to incent individuals to look after and care for themselves, or should it be one that continues to find other ways to place government in control or in the care of people rather than you know, empowering them to look after themselves in their future? And obviously we've seen the failures of MNsure and other things in its inability not only to function properly but to also meet the specific needs of individuals. So Representative O'Driscoll, thanks for bringing this forward.
Thank Mr. Chair, if I could just add one other comment.
Sure.
To Representative Draskowski's observations on this, one of the things that we as a legislature in the short time that I've been here grapple over with this, how many dollars we put into HHS, nursing homes, assisted living, all of these different kinds of things, 5% formulas and things. Mm-hmm. This puts another player out there that can be a predictable and steady source of income to long-term care in skilled facilities, and some of the contracts are written so that you can stay in your own home and still receive these kinds of services, which are less dollars that would be asked for by the state, and allow those policies to amortize the benefits over a longer period of time as well.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Representative O'Driscoll and a comment and then a question. Last Sunday in church, Mrs. Olson came up to me, and she seemed a bit upset. I thought she was going to slug me, but she said, my long-term health insurance went up $400. And she was sure it was a politician's fault. I tried to tell her I had nothing to do with it, but I'll get down to the bottom of it. And she said several of her friends, the coffee ladies that meet after church, she shared that same sentiment, that their long-term care went up. Not sure they can afford it. They're all on health, you know, fixed income. So I came down to the Capitol here on Monday and did a little investigating, and was told by some research that part of the increase was because of the ACA. And then there was a couple other determining factors. Have you, in your research, witnessed or at least heard of also folks in your district that the cost of this long-term care insurance has gone up and is unsustainable? I'm sure I'm not the only one that someone comes up to church or grocery store or wherever saying, hey, this has gone up. What's the deal? So maybe you shared that earlier. If you could answer that question, that would be great.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald. It's going to be anecdotal again on this, but when long-term care policies are issued, the idea was that you try to be able to get a fixed premium on that. Many companies aren't obligated to keep those premiums. They certainly want to stay competitive because they'd like to have the premiums or the policy stay in place. But again, like health insurance, they are subject to adjustment on the premiums. We don't have any laws that say you have to keep it at the rate of issuance, which there are some issues with that as well. So like you say, it's anecdotal at best. I can say that the policies that I'm aware of and people I've talked to or people closer to my age have not seen premium increases, but I have not done a survey in my district or put out a questionnaire to gain more specific information.
McDonald.
Thank you. Well, Mrs. Olson didn't care if it was anecdotal or not. For her, it was a fact. So I think this is a great piece of legislation that we can offer some, you know, help and assistance. So I hope that hopefully we'll all support this as we go into our senior moments.
And just for the committee, the lapse ratio on long-term care policies is about 1%, so it's pretty low. People do, as a rule, keep them. I will say that it is one of the toughest policies to get in place as far as selling it. People just, they put that off. They don't want to think about it. But in working with a financial planner, one of the first things they're going to do is they're going to look at this, because this saves the estate for those that you want it to go to. So, okay, any other questions for Representative O'Driscoll? If not, I will move the House File 407 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much, and I would like to talk to you further on this. So,
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Item last We have a consent calendar item here, House File 710. We have Kosnick, if you could, Representative Kosnick, if you could join us at the front table here. Representative Kosnick moves House File 710. Are there any amendments?
Are they author amendments?
Okay, if you could please, if the pages could please hand out the A4 amendment. Okay, thank you very much. And then on this bill, when we get into member questions, Chair Carlson will have the first question. So do we have an A4 amendment here?
Mr. Chair, I have a copy of it.
Okay, we'll wait until like members get a copy. So, members, I have an A3 and an A2. Who wants to lay claim onto those? What's that? Okay, we'll come to that later. So to do the amendment, this gets the bill in the shape that the author would like, I believe.
A4 is what I was given this morning.
A4. So let's do A4, then we've got a couple other ones to look at here a little bit later. I will move the, or Representative Kosnick was the H0710 A4 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevailed. Okay, so please present your bill, sir.
Thank you, Chair Davids and members of the committee, for hearing this file. And, you know, it's not a tax adventure without a snack, so I'm happy to present from the Lakeville Girl Scout Troop 25523. That's my 8-year-old daughter, Claire, who's actually still a brownie, and my younger daughter, Carly. She's only a daisy, but I hope you enjoy the Girl Scout cookies. And if you want to buy some more, let me know.
To the bill.
I'm happy to bring forth this bipartisan bill with your support and hope that it will become part of the transportation plan this year. House File 710 deals with tax funds that are currently generated when a person leases a motor vehicle. The original 2008 intention of the motor vehicle lease tax was to allocate half the funds towards Greater Minnesota Transit and the other half to the County State Aid Highway Fund for the metro counties of Anoka, Washington, Carver, Scott, and Dakota. And so what my bill does is it reaffirms that the collected revenue is distributed as intended for roads and bridges and buses. The distribution arrangement was agreed to as a way to offset an increase in the general sales tax to the metro counties for transportation projects that mainly originate in Hennepin and Ramsey County through the County Transit Investment Board. So currently the first $32 million of the funds are diverted from the transportation and absorbed into the general fund. What our bill does is distributes all the revenue from the lease tax to be shared between Greater Minnesota Transit and metro counties, as mentioned. The revenue beyond the $32 million are supposed to go to the 50-50% allocation as well. And originally, the set-aside of the first $32 million was to provide qualifying tax filers with a tax credit to offset the new gas taxes and fees that were passed in 2008, but I'm not sure that those credits ever transpired. But we do continue to short Greater Minnesota and the Metro County roads by the first $32 million. And in fact, last year, the counties were capped at receiving only $9 million. So I think we all can agree that we do need to reprioritize transportation funding both in the short and long term. And our support of this bill does this with current and dedicated funding stream and not increasing taxes or higher fees. And these funds were originally created and intended for transportation to help folks across the state in both Greater Minnesota and the suburbs. In suburban families, over 1.2 million Minnesotans have been paying more than their fair share of increased gas taxes, sales taxes, property taxes, and fees for the last 7 years, and are facing more tax increases again. And taxpayers deserve, I think, what was promised to them in the original 2008 plan. And so it's time to finally deliver on the promises made in the 2008 to Minnesotans and to stop shifting away $32 million out of transportation. So thank you for supporting House File 10. 710, I'm sorry.
I don't think anybody said they support it. So we will take testimony now. Okay, but first of all, before we start, is there anyone, I see that we have three folks down here, is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on behalf of the bill? Okay. Is there anyone that wishes to testify with concerns on the bill? You can do both. That's fine. Okay, is there anyone from the department that wishes to get in this one? No. Okay. Very smart department. Okay. With that, let's go with your first witness. Now we have Ms. Bingham. We have
Mr. Carlson.
You're a resource person. Okay. And then we'll have Ms. Davison come down. Chair Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, can we have the staff describe how this originally was set up?
I know that's a very good idea. Yes.
Before we start into the Ms. Dalton, pieces.
What are we doing here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the sales tax on motor vehicle leases has actually been in existence for a very long time. I believe it was in, I'm going to look around and see if anyone nods along with me, 2005 that it was made an upfront tax. So the tax was paid on the entire lease at the time that the lease was entered into, as opposed to on a payment-by-payment basis. And then I believe a year later, the money was dedicated. The money was dedicated, as was earlier described, $32 million was supposed to be kept in the general fund to be used to offset the cost of a low-income tax credit for the increase in the gas tax. That tax credit was never paid, but $32 million has remained in the general fund, with the remainder divided between the two accounts.
Okay. Thank you. Let's go into testimony. Then I have Carlson and Simonson, and we will go from there. So please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Inter-County Association that consists of 10 of the regional center counties in greater Minnesota and 4 of the ring counties here in the metropolitan area.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. We appear in support of this bill. We believe it honors the compromise that was struck in 2008. It addresses the unique circumstances of the ring counties and how they can raise revenues for transportation and the manner in which transit is provided in those communities. And it provides additional needed funding for transit in greater Minnesota counties. To give you some background of what's occurred, I've distributed a handout that shows one piece of the compromise that occurred in 2008. As most of the members know, at that time, with the enactment of the transportation funding that bill, a quarter cent sales tax was authorized to be levied by the metropolitan counties. 5 of those counties have elected to do that: Hennepin, Ramsey, Anoka, Washington, to Dakota. All of those monies goes towards providing assistance on both the capital side and operating side for what are called transit ways, or what many of you refer to as light rail. Two primary beneficiaries are Hiawatha Light Rail and Central Corridor, or the blue or green lines. The tax brings in approximately a little over $100 million a year. The grants that have gone out for 2008 through 2013, as the members will see, all the monies go towards lines that either originate or terminate in Hennepin and Ramsey County, and 82% of the money that has gone out historically has gone to lines that both originate and terminate in those counties. So I think that side of the bargain has been more than kept in providing those dollars. The bill has originally introduced and came out of the Senate also provided a second quarter percent sales tax that was ultimately deleted from the bill to gain passage in the House and in a subsequent veto override. That quarter cent was intended to provide monies for roads of regional significance. When that was deleted, basically the Ring County's delegations cried foul. And in lieu of that money to garner their votes, what was provided was a distribution of a portion of the leased motor vehicle sales tax. 50% of the receipts in excess of $32 million annually. Also, to address concerns of Greater Minnesota, the other 50% of the receipts in excess of $32 million was given to Greater Minnesota Transit. And with the exception of last year, that's how the monies have gone out ever since. In the early days of that provision, the tax didn't raise enough money to hit that $32 million threshold. Right now, in 2015, about $18.6 million is going to both purposes. Okay? So that's where we stand right now. And as I said, this really addresses some unique circumstances that exist specifically within suburban counties. Because three of them have elected to assist in the funding of these transitways, they are precluded from levying the up to 0.5% local option sales tax for transportation purposes that all other counties in greater Minnesota have the ability to do, and 11 have elected to do them. Because they elect to support transitways, they can't access this revenue source. Then further, as I noted here, the transitways really don't serve commuters within their counties. They basically bring individuals to or from Hennepin and Ramsey County. They don't get people around Dakota County. They don't get people around Anoka County. They don't get people around Washington County. And Carver, frankly, finds itself in similar circumstances. No transitway is planned that will serve those counties in the foreseeable future. Their transit for these individuals who need to get around their counties is provided by buses that travel on roads. They don't travel on rails. They don't travel on dedicated busways. So these monies go towards serving the needs of their residents. Finally, I'll let others, address concerns with Greater Minnesota Transit, but transit is an important thing, particularly for the counties I represent. The four scheduled transit systems in Minnesota are all located in the Greater St. Cloud area, Mankato, Rochester, and Duluth. And those systems need money, just as the system here in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. There are going to be concerns raised about, what's the fairness of this? And I think every one of the veteran legislators on this committee knows that there are all sorts of special provisions, whether we're talking about education aids, local government aids, county program aids, the medical assistance programs that are adapted to address the unique circumstances of individual communities. And this is one of them. And we think it's very fair. We support strongly the measure here that addresses the concerns of the Greater Minnesota Transit as well as the Ring Counties. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
And thank you, Mr. Carlson. I think we'll wait on questions until we have the testimony. I want to get the testimony, and then we'll go to member questions. If you could state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm Carla Bigham. I'm Washington County Commissioner from Cottage Grove. And my friend over here is Dakota County Commissioner Nancy Schuweiler. First, I want to thank Representative Kosnick for bringing this bill forward and introducing it. House File 710 does honor a deal that was struck in 2008 that provides over $100 million annually for light rail and transitways for Hennepin and Ramsey County transit lines that originate or terminate in their counties, all the while giving the five ring counties assistance of $18.6 million in from the lease motor vehicle sales tax to fund their residents' transportation needs and the same for Greater Minnesota for their resident transit needs. This bill addresses several issues that were created for the suburban counties, specifically for Washington. Washington County loses on the current CASA formula, the county state aid for highways formula. Washington County, if they were just to receive the average statewide aid on a per capita basis, would receive an additional $13.4 million annually. When the 2008 transportation funding bill was debated, Washington County initially thought it would receive money from a second quarter percent metro sales tax for roads of regional significance. Some of this Mr. Carlson has already explained, but the second quarter cent ultimately was dropped from the bill, leaving Washington County out in the cold, as in cold like today, cold, absent the money from the lease motor vehicle sales tax. Under the transportation funding proposals of the other body and the governor, Washington County would best see a permanent revenues equivalent to a eighth of a cent sales tax after the metro sales tax on our residents is raised by either three-fourths of a cent under the other body's proposal or half cent under the governor's proposal. Washington County will continue to be permanently barred from levying local sales tax of up to a half cent for transportation purposes, as Mr. Carlson had explained that the other counties do get to do. House File 710 helps Washington County address its expanding population and business transportation needs by providing an estimated $3.2 million annually without raising state taxes. Provides an additional $16 million annually for Greater Minnesota Transit. So, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony, and I can be available for questions.
That'd be great. I'd like, yes, that's, if you could stick around, that'd be wonderful. Ms. Davison? Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mary Beth Davidson, Director of Intergovernmental Relations for Hennepin County, and thank you. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify. I just wanted to put on the record that Hennepin County supports this bill, but we would like to be a part of it. In all fairness, when this deal was cut in 2008, this fund was pretty much flat. There wasn't a lot of money in it. It's projected to be $85 million. Hennepin County, Ramsey County, we generate a lot of lease motor vehicle sales tax money. This really isn't about transit, it's about highways, and we have a lot of highway needs in Hennepin County as well. We have about 32% of our county stated highway roads that are 50 years or older. The projected cost of fixing those roads is about $1 billion. We have a lot of things that we provide to other counties. We have Hennepin County Medical Center, which is a large public hospital, and I'm sure a lot of the collar counties have people that come to the hospital for care. I mean, I think it's a fairness issue, and I just wanted to put that on the record. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. Anyone else wish to testify? Ms. Munyon? You know, while Ms. Munyon's coming down, is there anyone else in the audience that's come in that wishes to testify on this bill? Okay, we have another gentleman here, and then the department is not. Okay. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Sherry Munyon, and I represent the Minnesota Public Transit Association. This is an organization that represents the bus operators throughout the state of Minnesota, as well as their riders. A couple of quick facts for you. There are 52 public transit systems that are currently serving 79 of the 80 counties in Minnesota, delivering over 12 million rides a year to Greater Minnesota citizens. And that has grown dramatically over the past decade due to the need that they have seen. Greater Minnesota Public Transit has increased 32.4%, while service hours have also increased 21%. The service has expanded so that every county except for Waseca has at least some public bus service. And in our Minnesota statutes, there is a goal of reaching 80% of the identified need by 2015 and 90% by 2025. Just to give you an idea where we are at today, we're not going to make 80% of the need. We're at about 63% today for Greater Minnesota transit service. The exciting thing about the 2008 bill was that bill for the first time provided a clear path and hope for citizens who live outside of the seven county metro area that they would have some assistance in their transportation needs. This allows them to stay in their communities, particularly with our seniors, versus having to move to a larger metropolitan area where bus service might be provided for them. So we certainly support the bill as it is in front of you and hope that there wouldn't be any amendments to eliminate transit funding in greater Minnesota for those citizens.
Thank you, Ms. Munyon. If the gentleman could please come down. And Ms. Munyon, maybe if you could stick around here too, in case members have questions. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lars Negstedt. I represent Isaiah. Isaiah is a faith-based organization of over 100 congregations statewide working for racial and economic justice in the state, including a number of congregations in St. Cloud and a number of other places around the state. We've been working hard on transportation issues for a number of years, and in particular lifting up the concerns we hear around the state for needs for transit funding in greater Minnesota. As the population ages and diversifies, those needs are only growing, and 60% meeting 63% of need across the state, as Ms. Munyon testified, in our view is frankly just not nearly enough. So we are in support of Representative Kosnick's bill and would like to thank him for bringing this forward. Note that there's strong bipartisan support for this bill. We think that there needs to be this dedicated stream of funding for Greater Minnesota Transit, and we agree, we hope this bill will move forward in its current form, and we also would have concerns about amendments that would weaken the ability to make sure that transit needs are met for Greater Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I think that is a good segue, members, before we go into member questions, to get the A2 amendment before us. And so if Representative Drazkowski moves the H0710 A2 amendment. Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, the A2 amendment takes the rural portion of that's offered in this bill and basically funnels the money to counties and then gives them the ability to decide whether they want to use the money for transit or for roads and bridges. Members, we've had this discussion. I'm also on the Transportation Committee, and with all due respect to the transit folks, I don't hear from county commissioners, I don't hear from citizens that we need to, in our rural counties, the transit is a need beyond what we have now. As a matter of fact, there's lack of coordination, as I understand, between, I think, some of the needs that we would see for transit, and that would be the disabled folks and some of the folks in nursing homes. I've talked to some of those people in some of our counties, and there's not the coordination with them and the transit operators. So what evidently has evolved here, members, is these transit operator groups, along with the Department of Transportation, have provided for the distribution of the current funds that go to transit with the county boards or people in local government in some of our counties anyway. I don't know about the rest. Not being directly enough involved in those decision-making exercises. As a matter of fact, as I talk to my constituents and to county commissioners, roads and bridges are the need, and to continue to build out more transit for our rural areas is not the priority that roads and bridges are. So this would, Mr. Chair, give the ability for counties to receive that money and then for them to decide how it would be spent on roads and bridges or on transit in their locality. I just want to offer this, Mr. Chair, for discussion, and then my intention is to really not go forward with the amendment.
Okay. Chair Anderson. Pass. Chair Lencheski.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Representative Drazkowski, thank you. I just wanted to be clear as I was listening to and seeing the amendment, because we had not voted on any amendments this year except for authors' amendments to get it the form they would like it. I was, just going to say that we didn't know that there would be actual votes taken on these bills today, so I appreciate that that's not happening, and I hope as we mark up the transfer, whether it's going to be in your bill, Mr. Chair, or the transportation bill coming through taxes, you know, that we will have sufficient time to work on amendments in the transportation area and taxation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Trustee. And that would be my intention. Representative Chair Knobloch.
Mr. Chairman, I guess Representative Druskowski, I appreciate you bringing it forward just for discussion. I'd say that for my particular area in St. Cloud, there's more complexities than there probably is for most greater Minnesota communities, and that the amendment proposes to now give the money to counties instead, but in fact my legislative district and the St. Cloud area actually lies in three counties, and so we have a transit authority that covers the three counties, and while they certainly cooperate, this puts a situation in place where perhaps one county wants the money for something, perhaps the other two counties are happy with it being in transit, and at least for my particular situation, and I don't know if other people face this, this adds some complexity and problems for transit in my community, where you might have the majority of the counties still wanting to have the transit system, but maybe one county that all of a sudden differs on it. And so I guess I appreciate that we're not going to be voting on the amendment, but I just register that concern.
Thank you, Chair Knobloch. Chair Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that's the same thing that's going on in the metro area here. Some want and some don't, but they all want some. That's exactly what's doing. Going on. Anyway, Mr. Chairman, don't we have, haven't we given the right to the rural counties to raise money for transportation purposes, including transit? Does somebody on the staff want to refresh my...
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, every county that is not part of the metropolitan transit area, which means the 80 counties in greater Minnesota plus the two counties that did not join the metropolitan transit area, have the ability by county resolution to impose a sales tax for transportation purposes, including transit purposes.
Chair.
So my suggestion is if Representative Druskowski needs more money in his county, he should talk to his commissioners who have the right to set that in motion. And if they want to make it directly to roads and forget transit, that's up to them. Local control at its best.
Representative Earhart, anything else? Okay, Chair Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Earhart, I appreciate that. And but I don't know about your county, but in my counties, the commissioners have the needs of the taxpayers on the front of their minds, first and foremost, and also the efficient use of the funds that are available to them is also first and foremost. And when there is money being spent on something that might not be a priority relative to other things, they try to do their best to fund the priority properly. And we need to give them the flexibility to use the limited resources that taxpayers in this state have to properly, precisely and responsibly deploy that. So, Mr. Chair, wanted to bring this forward for discussion. I hope we can continue to have this discussion, as was mentioned earlier, regardless of how actually these decisions happen around transportation this session. But I'll continue to be in contact with you and Representative Lucheski and Chair Kelly and others about that, and I'm hopeful that we can keep in mind the local control in this case of the county to most efficiently, effectively, precisely, and responsibly use those dollars, and that's what this attempts to do. Thank you.
Okay, Chair Druskowski withdraws the H07108-2 amendment. Okay, thank you, members. Now, questions for, and you can call up whoever we want to call up here, Chair Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just want to make a comment. I don't have a question unless somebody wants to comment about it. But being that several people have come in the room since my earlier comments when I wasn't totally sure which bill I should make my comments on, dealt with the distribution, and I was giving a little background information in terms of a compromise, I'll use the word, that we reached last spring on the distribution of some of these funds. And we had earlier testimony that the fund had been basically flat. Well, last year there was unexpected growth. I think I may have used the term windfall, but maybe a better term is unexpected growth in the fund. And those dollars were going to go mainly to Greater Minnesota and transit. And the Ring counties came to me during the conference committee that we had for the supplemental appropriations bill with the concern about how those dollars were going to be distributed. And so, as I said earlier, I worked with members of our transportation committee, with representatives from the Ring counties, I think probably more from Dakota County than virtually any place else, and my Senate counterparts. And we put together a compromise. The Greater Minnesota folks felt that it was almost too much too fast, and they said they would like money in corridors of commerce. And so part of the compromise then was that we were shifting some dollars around. We took dollars, transportation dollars, and moved them into the corridors of commerce. So it became a wash for Greater Minnesota. They didn't lose any money on that exchange. Used the dollars then off the sales tax on long-term lease cars to go to the Ring counties. Well, then that left the problem with Hennepin and Ramsey, because this earlier compromise that was alluded to, and from my perspective, and I think everybody knows that I'm a Hennepin County legislator, that unfortunately Hennepin County and Ramsey County were not part of that earlier agreement and were left out. So we did take some additional funds last spring, and we allocated funds for two projects, one each in Hennepin and Ramsey County, to try to bring about a temporary balance. So we took care of Greater Minnesota, the Ring counties, tried to help Hennepin and Ramsey. But that was a one-time fix. And we still have the issue before us that two large metropolitan counties, Hennepin and Ramsey, are not built into the formula. Now, I'm not talking about changing the distribution between Greater Minnesota and the metro area, but I did have a handout that would show what the distribution would be in the seven-county metropolitan area if you did include Hennepin and Ramsey, and only at a 50% population level. It would be that in of itself would be a concession on the part of Hennepin and Ramsey if this were to come about, where only 50% of the population would be recognized. But you'd see what the distribution would be there. And I would like to point out that some of the testimony talked about helping suburban counties. And Hennepin and Ramsey do have significant suburbs. So not only would you be potentially helping the two cities of the first class, but you do have significant suburbs in both Hennepin and Ramsey. So that's the way the distribution would look if you did include two of our key counties in the metropolitan area. I don't have an amendment here today to deal with that, understanding that this bill will be talked about, or the transportation issue, later, but I do want to alert members to what it might look like if we did help those two counties.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chair Carlson, for that. This is an interesting issue that I think we are going to have to tackle, and some of my friends are for this, some of my friends are against this, and I'm with my friends. Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Many of my comments were going to be directed towards the A2, which has been withdrawn, so I'll save that discussion for another day. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Simonson. Representative Earhart, and then Laffa. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Every once in a while, we have to remind people in this legislature that the breadbasket of the state is the seven-county metro area, and then specifically the two gold nuggets.
Chair Earhart, I thought it was the Iron Range.
That's iron, not gold.
Okay. Chair Earhart, I'm sorry. Chair Earhart.
And in particular, the two nuggets, the real gold nuggets, are Ramsey and Hennepin County. So just, I'm going to ask staff to be more specific than I'm going to be here. But in general, you know, these figures are from tax year 2010, because I think that's the last audited income tax item that was available here. And that first of all, 68%, you all know that most of our tax revenue to the state comes from income and sales tax. Everybody knows that, right? Right. Okay. And 68% of the amount paid by Minnesota residents on the income tax was from the Seven County metro area, with 32% paid by returns from Hennepin County and 8.7% from Ramsey. So 44% of the monies that you all want to spend everywhere comes out of Hennepin and Ramsey County on their income taxes. Then we go to the sales tax, where we find that in 2011, a little better update because now audited, 64.2% of the amount paid by Minnesota residents was reported by the Department of Revenue was coming from the Seven County metro area, 34.4% from Hennepin County and 11.2% on Ramsey County returns. So that's 45% of the sales taxes. 44% of the income taxes come out of Ramsey and Hennepin. Now, you all like to spend this wherever, and we bought a ballpark here in Hennepin County. Do you know that? I said we should name this thing Hennepin County Ball Team, not Minnesota Team, for heaven's sakes, because we're paying for it. We're paying for that thing where you come and enjoy yourselves on a hot summer evening. And I don't think that's right, so I voted against the damn thing. In any event, I think that we have more specific figures from Ms. Dalton on the sales tax that we're talking about here.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, nobody actually has direct amounts collected on a geographic region for long-term motor vehicle leases. However, we do have some information on two other series that are somewhat related to it. One is the motor vehicle sales tax collections. So assuming that long-term leases are distributed about the same way that motor vehicle sales purchases are distributed, 52% of it is in the metro area, of which 21% is in Hennepin County and 8.5% is collected in Ramsey County. The other way to look at it is there's information on sales tax collections by what are called North American Industrial Codes, and we can look at the sales tax collected from motor vehicle dealers. Most of that would be motor vehicle leases. Some of it would be motor vehicle repair parts, but a vast majority of it would be the leases entered into by motor vehicle dealers. 53.4% of that is collected in the metro area, and of that, 23.6% is collected in Hennepin County and 8.6% is collected in Ramsey County. Now, having said all of that, I will add one last caveat. All sales tax information is collected based on where the seller is located, not where the purchaser is located. So that's always a caveat when you're looking at sales tax data.
Chair Earhart?
Well, before you all start apologizing to Hennepin County for this dastardly trick you're trying to pull on them this time, we'll let it have more discussion.
Chair Earhart, I was not going to apologize. and when we voted on the stadium, I came over to you on the House floor and I thanked you. Yeah. And I thank Chair Lincheski.
It's going to be every year for 30 years, though.
I'm just getting going. Okay, so with that, Representative Kosnick, I think we have a bit of work to do on your bill. Before I go to Representative Loeffler and members, we do have to be out of the room by noon. Did the Dakota County Commissioner actually want to go on the record, or
not necessary.
Get paid mileage or something, or per diem? Okay. I'm just trying to help. I'm thinking. I'm looking out for you.
I appreciate that.
I love Dakota County. Okay, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And since someone who represents collar counties was describing their vision of what people live, how people live in Hennepin and Ramsey, I thought we may be able to correct the record, just like when someone mentions your name, you get to. And the vast majority of people in my communities and in those counties travel by bus, basic bus, in which they walk up to a half a mile and stand out in the wind and the cold and the rain and transfer to get anywhere they want to go. So while there are a few designer lines that have gone through and that have been expensive and that have been popular with people throughout the region, including people who commute in and park in our community so that they can avoid paying downtown parking fees but like to take transit to the office, there is a really different circumstance. And I'll just tell you that this summer when I decided I was invited to a transit improvement meeting that was held in North Minneapolis, I called Metro Transit, and for me to get there on that meeting would be going less than 4 miles from my house, would have taken 45 minutes each way in a transfer downtown. I have bus recipients who are riders who are routinely passed by buses in which it's standing room only and they couldn't squeeze one more body in. And when it's a 30 below wind chill and that bus drives by you and you're going to be late for work, it's not a pleasant experience. I have 20 to 25% of the residents of some of my neighborhoods who are totally transit dependent. There is not one single vehicle in the household. So this is the only way they can go to get groceries, they can get to work, they can get their kids to daycare. It's not a choice. At the same time, our roads are worn out too, just like everywhere else. I mean, we share that in common. We have in Hennepin County an average of over 700 vehicles per Kassaw lane mile. That's high. Ramsey is second. In the Metro County, the collar counties range from 224 to 630. So we all have roads that are being worn out. We all have inadequate transit needs, and we all need to work together on a solution that works for everyone.
Thank you, Chairman Chesky.
Mr. Chair, as you know, just going as we go forward, because you can see we're clearly going to get into it from a regional perspective when we do the transportation bill. And I just hope that we will get some of the data that Representative Earhart was talking about, where the revenues are collected, and very specifically to the motor vehicle lease sales, all these issues that are going on related to transportation that people, I think people will be very surprised what percentage is coming out of Hennepin and Ramsey County on those items. It's even actually higher. But, Mr. Chair, just, as we are going to all need a lot of information on this, because I think, and I suffer from this, that I don't understand other people's districts very well. When I go to Kenyon, I know I'm in Representative Draskowski's district, or if I, I'm in St. Cloud, I know I'm in Representative Knoblex. But I think what I notice often is that people who don't reside in Hennepin County, for example, think it's Minneapolis and like a little more, and it's actually 46 suburbs. And so, we have lots and lots of legislators from Hennepin County who have very different views on these items. And, I represent a community that isn't even a first-ring suburb. My city doesn't touch Minneapolis or St. Paul. There's Minneapolis and a ring of suburbs, and I know Representative Anderson is another ring out. So, we're very, very different communities in Hennepin, and we have, very different needs. And to be excluded from these formulas when, the revenue streams that they're generating is just, to me, I cannot be defended. And so, I hope as we go forward, we take a little time to understand that. I have a city that has, like I said, it doesn't even abut the major urban core, Mr. Chair, and yet it has the busiest transit center in the state of Minnesota, by far. By far. The council who's in the transit station at the Mall of America is overwhelmingly beyond any other transit station in the state. And hundreds of buses are pouring in there every day. And I will tell you, when you stand and people do these studies where they look at the license plates and they look at the zip codes of who's using both the buses and light rail, you know, some of the hugest winners are the next counties over. So Lakeville and Burnsville and all these folks who are in Dakota County and other counties, they're getting on the transit station in Bloomington. And so I think it's much more complicated than people are saying. And I just don't see how we could take, you know, a huge part of the state's population, ask them to pay overwhelmingly the largest part of the tax and then not be a recipient of the benefit. And I just hope we can really take time when we hear that transportation bill to have the time to see the numbers so that members aren't just using conjecture to understand where these revenues come from and where they're going. And I think it's just equally important to all of us, Mr. Chair. It's like, I know your district is important to you. Yes, Hennepin Ramsey feel like they're not getting the best deal going, you know, in these bills. So thank you for your time.
Well, thank you, Chair Lynchewski. It's not my intention to move this to the consent calendar. And to the author, you're talking to the one who coined the phrase peace in the valley. We have a big job on this one to get there. We'll wrap up with Representative Barrett, and then we will lay over for possible conclusion with the understanding of the committee that we got a lot of work to do on this one. Vice Chair Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Now, I didn't want to talk, but Representative Loeffler talked about transportation and packing people in and so forth. I've been on transit. New York was packed in. I was in Atlanta during the Olympics, 96, packed in. Then I get to Minnesota, and we have North Star. 5,000 cars were projected to come off the road because of North Star. 2,200 people use that a day, which means they're going two directions. So it's one person, two trips, down to 1,100 or fewer cars being taken off the road when it was projected to have 5,000. They're not packing them in, and we're paying a lot of money for that in many areas for that. We paid $330 million to build it, much of that federal, $100 million state. We have a $15 to $17 million operating budget for something that is underperforming by 80% or more. That's been subsidized by $40, roughly, round trip. We got to look at that. We got to look at that money and use it in the best possible way possible. I have a two-lane highway, Highway 8 in Chautauqua Lakes. Story was on air about half a year ago, the highway of death. It needs to be four lanes. Wasn't even in Governor Dayton's bill. He had two things for Chautauqua County. One, the Osceola Bridge, and another repaving 35 north in the northern part of my county. Didn't even include that. We got to start looking at that. And we have to use our money as efficiently as possible. Taxpayers expect that. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair. And I think, members, you know, we kind of have to separate this a little bit. We're not the Transportation Committee, but we are the Tax Committee. And there's huge tax implications on this bill, and I think Representative Kosnick, you see that, as I said before, we do have a lot of work to do on this to get to a resolution, and I think it can be done, but we're going to have everybody involved in the discussion. So with that, members, I will move that we lay over, or Representative Kosnick moves, we lay over House File 710 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Anything else for the good of the order? Not good government all the time. We are adjourned.